This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well Well Well, brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
You're with Michael on Well Well Well, recording on the lands of the Wurundjeri people and broadcasting on Boonwurrung land on Joy and the Community Radio Network. The recently released Rainbow Realities Report is an in-depth analysis of large-scale LGBTQA+ health and well-being in Australia, drawing upon research from Private Lives, Writing Themselves In, and SWOSH, just to name a few. Joining me to help explore Rainbow Realities Report is lead author Natalie Amos, research fellow with the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University. Natalie, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us here on Well Well Well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Beautiful. So just in kind of broad terms, what is Rainbow Realities as a report kind of all about? Can you share a little bit maybe about some of the surveys that this report draws its analyses from?
Yeah, sure. So the Rainbow Realities report was commissioned by the Department of Health and Ageing, and it was the intention of this report is to at least part inform the government's 10-year national action plan for LGBTQI+ health and well-being. So the report is a 200-plus page report that covers sort of new and existing findings that we have from about six surveys. So three of those are housed within ARCHES, the Australian Research Centre for Sex, Health and Society, which is where I work, and they are the Private Lives 3 survey, which is Australia's largest survey of LGBTQA+ adults, Writing Themselves In 4, also Australia's largest survey of LGBTQA+ young people aged 14 to 21, Pride and Pandemic, which was a survey that we ran during the pandemic of pandemic experiences within the community, particularly around mental health, family violence, and sort of management strategies that people used in the pandemic. The survey also includes the SWOSH survey, which is from housed within Sydney University, and is a survey of LGBTQ+ women's health and wellbeing from Sydney. Also from Western Australian colleagues is the Trans Pathways study, which is a study of trans and gender diverse young people aged 14 to 26 years, and that was conducted in 2016. And we also have the Wellcome Cutterjin survey in there as well, which is also known as Rainbow Knowledge, which is a survey that was dedicated to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander LGBTQA+ experiences.
Yeah, and so this report kind of reflects on some of those existing findings, but I think there's sort of something like 50-plus kind of new analyses that have been drawn through kind of comparing and contrasting some of those responses. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we kind of briefly give summaries of what we've already produced from these reports, and then, yeah, an additional 50-something else. I don't know the exact number of new analyses that we ran for this report to try to report on some more nuanced findings within the data.
Yeah, wonderful. It is a really large-scale report. It's quite a hefty read. It's really comprehensive, and it does cover a number of different aspects of our LGBTQA+ communities and our health and well-being. And so we thought we'd take some time today to kind of discuss some of the high-level learnings or outcomes or findings that have been found in the study. The first thing I want to talk about was the way that our community kind of connects with alcohol and other drugs. There are obviously high rates of alcohol and drug use in our LGBTQA+ communities. Were there any important reflections on the health outcomes associated with drugs and alcohol?
Yeah, as you said, the report does reflect that high prevalence of alcohol and other drug use across the community. And we see in there sort of, you know, potentially a normalization within many LGBTQ subcultures of alcohol and other drug use. But we also find associations with various mental health outcomes, sort of increased psychological distress, and also other demographic factors that are linked to sort of significant disadvantage or marginality within the community. We can't assume cause here that this is all very correlational research. So we can just say that there's an association between alcohol and drug use and those factors, which is to say that it may be in a response to, you know, increased mental health concerns, and in response to that, we see increased alcohol and other drug use. Interestingly, we also observe greater drug use among young trans people of all genders who had access to gender-affirming care. So we see sort of this outcome with a positive experience of accessing gender-affirming care. But again, I think it's not really talking to cause, and it might be my thoughts on this is that it's more along the lines of young people who have access to the affirming care that they need are connecting socially the way that young people do. And so we might see more increased drug use because they're young people getting to be young people.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of one of my reflections in reading the report. Quite often when we talk about alcohol and other drugs in our community, it's either from kind of a deficit model, or we're talking about the, you know, potential negative social and economic consequences, health consequences. So yeah, I was really interested mm-hmm. to learn if there were any kind of positive reports of the ways that our community connect with drugs and alcohol. And it sounds like, you know, waxing and waning that there may be.
Yeah, yes, I think so. And I think this deserves more research as well, to kind of tease out those nuances. As I said, we can really just talk to there's an association here. But yes, I think there is something to be said for community connection and social connections, as well as potential coping with stresses.
Yeah. And moving on, data from SWASH, which you mentioned earlier, which is Australia's longest running regular survey of lesbian, bisexual and queer women, for bi plus people and people with disability were disproportionately experiencing intimate partner violence. Was that surprising at all, the impacts of, you know, the bi plus community specifically?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it in some ways reflects previous research and in some ways not. So it's a tricky one to understand. Yes and no that it's surprising. We do see high rates of family violence within the LGBTQ community broadly. I think that this one is unclear why for bi plus folk that it is higher. And again, I think it really needs some more research there. You mentioned as well the results around disability as well was I think some of the highest rates of family violence that we have within the community among those with disability. Sadly, not surprising. It reflects previous research and reflects both disability research and LGBTQ research, but always very, very shocking. I think that finding that's probably the most striking to me from our data. Is the rates of family violence among those with disability?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know from Pride in Pandemic, that survey, in terms of the mental health of our community, I know LGBTQA plus communities were more likely to prefer services specifically that catered to them and their community. Are we at a deficit for those programs and services? Does this just speak to a larger need for non-mainstream services that have kind of a more targeted approach?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we are definitely at a deficit of LGBTQ-specific services and even LGBTQ-inclusive services within mainstream services. And we do see a much greater preference for services that are either inclusive or cater specifically to LGBTQ people, and that can differ across the population. So we find that trans people are more likely to prefer a service that's specifically LGBTQ people. And we know from community experiences that there is definitely that deficit, but our research also reflects that as well. So we saw a much greater preference for these services, but we didn't see participants accessing those services to the same extent that they preferred those services.
Yeah. Did any of the analyses draw upon, you know, for those people who are, you know, geographically not located near an affirming service, was there any report on the experiences of those people that couldn't get access to a service?
So interestingly, I think you're testing my memory here on the data, but from what I remember from analyses we've run, I think as you get further out of inner city areas, there tends to be more of a preference for a mainstream service that is inclusive. But I think that that might reflect a necessity or sort of a practicality around what's available in those areas where, you know, there's mainstream services should really be inclusive of LGBTQ, and not just inclusive, but affirming and practicing, affirming practice of for LGBTQA plus people. So I think there's potentially an element of this is my preference because it is what should be available to me, and practically what's accessible. Interestingly, with Pride and Pandemic, we ran some focus groups as well where we spoke to people, and the asking about preferences question, it was a bit more nuanced than what we could see coming through in the survey data. And there was this feeling of I would prefer an LGBTQ specific service, but acknowledging that there's just not the availability of it. So the preference might be expressed for a mainstream inclusive service.
Yeah, it might be for a peer within a mainstream service or an LGBTQA plus affirming service, I guess. And that speaks to a lot of the experiences of our community, especially when we're talking about our mental health and the way that the onus is always on the person, you know, presenting at, you know, at a counselling service or wherever to consistently, you know, validate their own experience and the emotional energy and the spoons, I guess, it takes to make sure that you feel seen and heard within a service. You're constantly kind of explaining yourself and your family and your cultural background and all those things. So yeah, when you only have a 30 minute appointment, it can be really time saving to to be with a peer.
Exactly, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Given that we are currently grappling with a housing crisis kind of nationally across the board, what does the report or the analyses from this report tell us about our community's experiences of homelessness and housing insecurity? Are they different across the acronym?
Yeah, so we see sort of higher rates of housing insecurity, income insecurity across the LGBTQ population. We do see higher rates of housing insecurity for trans folk, for cis women, for people with disability. We also found it among BIPOC participants as well. And I think what it really illustrates is the kind of cumulative impact of multiple sources of disadvantage, and these sort of barriers to accessing employment and housing across the community and for different intersections of the community.
Something that really stuck out to me when delving into this report, Natalie, was around the clarification that the survey had a really small number of intersex respondents. What kind of considerations are there for future surveys and meaningful engagement for our intersex communities?
Yeah, so it's a really good question and good one to bring up. So we did, at least for Private Live 3 and Writing Themselves in 4, which are the surveys that sit within my centre, we did target the recruitment as LGBTIQ+, so we were hoping to recruit people from intersex community. We got a very small, as you said, a very small sample size that of people that did have an intersex variation, the vast majority also identified as LGBTQ, so it was more like we got a sample of LGBTQ+ people with an intersex variation. So we can't disaggregate that data, unfortunately, or meaningfully represent that community within the data. So we tend to use LGBTQA plus as the acronym. I think there are challenges in how the survey recruitment was framed as LGBTIQ plus. Those from an intersex community might not necessarily identify with LGBTIQ, and it was a lot of the advertising was done through targeted advertising, through social media. So that really sort of targets those that have engaged with LGBTQ content online. I think what it really illustrates is that there is this very big need for focused, targeted, specific research for the intersex community. Happily, there has been some research, some recent MRFF, the Medical Research Future Fund, funding for a project that will be dedicated to intersex community, and that's been funded to the Sydney University, and Morgan Carpenter, who will be leading that work, and Arches will very likely get to collaborate on that. And that will be, will get us some much larger, much needed research dedicated to intersex community.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing a little bit more about that community. It is something that we talk about within community, and community iterates to us in terms of, you know, it's very easy to throw out the full gamut of letters of the acronym, so using the full LGBTIQA+, especially in services when you're looking at funding for things. But really it is important to, if you know, include the I if you're working with the I, and if you're not working with the I, to not use it, which you guys have done in this case. So
Yes, exactly.
So definitely looking forward to some more research and engagement in that space. I wanted to ask about one of the themes of the report was around the relationships of our communities. And something that we hear anecdotally from community is that for women who have sex with men who have sex with men, they may be overlooked when it comes to things like accessing PEP or accessing PrEP for preventing HIV, because their HIV risk might be seen as negligible erroneously by medical practitioners. And so sometimes these women go to access things like PrEP and don't get good access to it because they're not seen as an HIV risk. But I was reading through the report, and it seems like those women who have sex with men who also have sex with men are more likely to be proactive about accessing testing. So I thought that was a really interesting comparison. Can you flesh that out a little for us?
It is a very interesting finding. Yeah, we did find that the participants from the SWOSH survey were very proactive about their healthcare. We actually saw that in multiple ways. We even saw very proactive about accessing mental health care as well. So I think that there is, yeah, it's a really nice kind of good news story from this data as well. I think we need to also consider, though, that where the sample comes from. So it is it's an entirely Sydney-based sample. So it's potential that it likely reflects that specific demographic of women as well. But yeah, we did see very sort of proactive healthcare, and I think that it speaks to, you know, the capacity of the community to really take charge of their healthcare and look after themselves. But we do need public health messaging and healthcare training to make sure that all LGBTQ people are given the sort of appropriate care and understanding of what care they need. We also see in the report, we've also reported on some research around cervical screening access among LGBTQ community, where we do see a lot less cervical screening access broadly. And this was something that we collaborated with the Cancer Council Victoria on, who have actually taken the findings of that work to inform their public health messaging to sort of support the way that they use inclusive language within that space as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've previously worked with Cancer Council Victoria on our public cervix announcement campaign, which really was their kind of first venture into the inclusion of trans men specifically in their campaigning to getting access to cervical cancer screening for all people who have a cervix. I wanted to ask about thinking about gender affirming care in private lives. One of the really standout statistics I was reading was around only 1/3 of trans adults had ever experienced gender euphoria, so you know, a real alignment with their gender. What did the report have to say about kind of the protective factors that allow people to have, you know, better health outcomes for our trans and gender diverse communities?
Yeah, some of the trans affirming care research that we've reported in this report is some of my favourite. We do definitely see for adults being able to access different forms of gender affirmation. So whether that's legal affirmation or social affirmation or medical affirmation was associated with feeling gender euphoria. We also see that experience of gender euphoria is associated with positive mental health outcomes as well. And we also see other benefits of having access to gender affirming care, particularly among young people. We've reported on whether they, among those who desired access to whether it's social, medical, or legal gender affirmation, if they had access to those forms of care that they desired, those forms of affirmation, sorry, that they desired, they were less likely to experience suicidality and homelessness, but particularly if they had felt supported to affirm in those ways. So we asked young people who had wanted to affirm their gender in these ways whether they had felt denied, delayed or controlled to access it, or whether they had felt supported. And overwhelmingly, we see that those who have felt supported to access that care, whether it's medical affirmation, legal affirmation or social affirmation, they experienced less suicidality, less psychological distress, lower anxiety, greater happiness, less homelessness. And I think one thing that really stood out for me as well was that they experienced less verbal abuse in the past 12 months. So there's this really, you know, it's very important to be able to access that care, and it's hugely important to feel supported to access that care.
Yeah. There were also some really interesting kind of key findings around, you know, things like social connection and attending, I think, community groups and events, and how that kind of offered a kind of a protective factor for trans communities as well.
Yeah. So we see across the population as well, we see sort of a mixed bag around accessing community support, in that sometimes community support, we see higher rates of suicidality, those that engage with community support, but really that is very likely to affect those that are experiencing some form of distress or seeking out community for support to manage that. And we do see particularly those with disability who had connected with LGBTQ community had more positive health and wellbeing outcomes. So yeah, it does. There is evidence in the report as well of how important it is to be able to access community support and engage with community.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously one of the reports that the surveys that this report draws from is Pride and Pandemic. So looking at the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on our communities, was there anything that was that kind of stood out to you in terms of the ways that, you know, the decreased social connection played havoc amongst our communities during that time?
Yeah, yes. So again, kind of, the pandemic was a bit of an interesting time in that, yeah, absolutely, we saw that isolation and lack of ability to connect with community definitely seems to have had an impact on well-being. Also, you know, having young people stuck at home with families that aren't necessarily supportive of them, and not being able to access friends or even to be out of the house to in spaces that are more affirming of their identities. On the flip side, we also saw an increase in online spaces of connection, and for some, particularly in rural and remote areas, people sort of spoke to us of how beneficial it was to finally have this online way of connecting with people where they didn't have to travel into inner city areas. So there was that benefit for those that didn't previously have access to community, now having access to community more easily. And I think that's, I think it's hopefully continued past the pandemic, that we maintain both that the in-person and the online spaces for those that can't access it. But also, again, it illustrates that we need more of it. We need more queer-friendly spaces and affirming spaces across all regions of the country.
Yeah, definitely. Natalie, I wanted to ask about some of the key findings relating to, we obviously have an ageing population in Australia, and we have an ageing population of, you know, things like people living with HIV and trans communities that we haven't experienced to such a degree before. Do you know? Can you speak to some of the kind of general responses to how LGBTQA plus older people have, you know, responded to things like loneliness and belonging and social isolation and those things?
Yeah, so we did actually have an interesting finding with the older LGBTQA plus adults from the Private Lab 3 data, so our adult sample, where we actually found that they appeared to be less likely than younger cohorts to report feelings of loneliness. And they also generally had a greater number of close friends. So I think it potentially reflects that sort of the role of community connectedness as a way of navigating the kind of societal and institutional discriminations that they might have experienced. So they've potentially had time to kind of build these close connections that have led to them experiencing less loneliness. I think it's also probably important to take into consideration, again, the sample that we are drawing from, which was all collected online. So it's potentially older folks who are more connected in online spaces as well. That's how they would have come across the survey, which would most likely have been through Facebook, I suppose.
Yeah,
Facebook advertising. But we did also see within the older cohort that when they did experience greater loneliness, this was also associated with experiencing unfair treatment due to their sexuality or their gender identity.
Yeah, and was that specifically related to things like mainstream services or?
So we ask it. It's a very broad question for you about have you ever experienced unfair treatment? Yeah, so it could be within services. It could just be
societal in general,
general public. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. I'm not sure what the kind of the age range of folk were in all of the surveys kind of combined. But did you have any reflections on the experiences of older LGBTQA plus people in you know homes and care settings? Was that reflected in any of the findings?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that given the nature of how we collected this sample, and definitely need for more research in that space that would be more dedicated and targeted and probably recruited in a different way within those settings rather than just recruiting online.
Thank you so much to Natalie Amos, Research Fellow at the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University. Thanks so much for joining us here on Well, Well, Well. Before I let you go, if people want to deep dive into this report as a whole or connect more with some of the surveys that kind of were reflected in these analyses, where can people go to find out more?
Yeah, we do actually have a dedicated webpage now through the Archer's website, which is through the La Trobe University website for Rainbow Realities. I think probably the easiest way, which is what I do, is just Google La Trobe Rainbow Realities and it should come up. And there on the website, you can access the full 200 plus page report.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again for your time to join us to discuss Rainbow Realities here on Well, Well, Well.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That's another episode of Well, Well, Well. Thank you so much to Natalie Amos, Research Fellow at the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society. If you missed any part of this week's episode or to find any of the links and discussion that we've talked about this week, check out the notes in our podcast, head to your favourite podcast platform app or go to joy.org.au/well, well, well.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and wellbeing and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.